Thanks. When you say taking a step back, it always reminds me. I was once watching Michael Barnsley, the eccentric English fractal theorist, giving a talk, and he took a step, but he took so many steps back, he fell off the bank. So it's not always.
Just have to follow by two steps forward.
It's not always a successful strategy to take a step back. Well, it depends on what you mean by success. Okay, but in this talk, you know, I do want to be provocative, and I know we're going to have an argument, and I'm sorry that Chuck isn't here, because he's one of the people I like to argue with. What I'm going to do is sort of introduce, I'm going to tell you how I got to the set of questions, which I'm going to introduce later in the talk. But first I want to really give you the message of the whole talk, which is a very simple message, and I think it's trivial and obvious, but sometimes I think it's outrageous and sometimes I think it's obvious, and I can't really work out which it is, but it seems to me to be empirically true. And this is that there is no fundamental level in biology. There's no bit level in the biological system. There are different levels of organization. There are brains talking to each other this month in this room. Within the brains, there are networks of neurons. There are networks of networks, that's the anatomy. Within those networks, there are networks of neurons. Within a neuron, there's a network of synapses, postsynaptic densities communicating through voltage and calcium signals. And within those synapses, there are networks of proteins. Within those protein complexes, networks of proteins, within the proteins, there's networks of amino acids, and so on. It goes down. Networks within networks. And what we're usually doing in science is trying to isolate one level of the network in order to learn about its rule-based behavior. And so quite often we will believe that the violation of the rule-based behavior is something called noise, and this is one of the things I've been ranting about for many years, which is not to think of the disturbance of the rule-based behavior that you're looking at as something which is noise. And this goes all the way down to when we're thinking about, if you're trying to think about trying to estimate some stimulus in the world, you can't think about the activity of the neuron that's not correlated with that stimulus in the world as noise, because that's the activity of the network of neurons in the brain, that's thought, right? So the brain is not just looking at things, it's also trying to think about them.
Johnny?
Yes?
It's a good thing that Jeff Lichtman didn't show up. He published a textbook, Fundamentals of Developmental Neurobiology, so he might... Just a joke.
Uh-huh. Okay. Oh, I mean, all the you know, of course there was Principles of Neuroscience by Candle and Schwartz, but I can't find any principles in there. It's a very big book.
The organization of voltage-gated sodium potassium channels. The membrane is producing action potential is a principle, is it not?
Let's
have that particular level.
It's not. There's theoretical physics and there's computational physics. Creating differential equations that model a system would be computational physics, and that would be computational neuroscience. I think theoretical physics and theoretical neuroscience should be about principles. In theoretical physics, we have Lagrangians. They are organizing principles for systems that have many different systems of many different types, and that's what we're missing in biology.
But I would argue that having positive feedback with a threshold followed by some antagonistic mechanism to give inactivation, to give directionality, to produce a directional pulse, is an organizational principle. You see it in Victor Speeding with chemical signaling.
Indeed, there is feedback in all systems. So I'm not sure that it's a principle. It's a thing that exists in all systems. But
are you saying that there's no separation of scale?
Yeah.
That you can make. I think that's the statement you're making, that you cannot safely.
That is the theme of my talk. That is the theme of my talk.
So you have time scale and length scale.
That is the theme of my talk. The theme of my talk is that the separation of scales is only partly holding.
But it's also true in physics or anything else. The reason we want to do it is because you can't do it first
time. You know, I really would like to say that I'm going to go into all these things at length during the talk. So you might want to.
And there's, you know, in physics you have very similar, you know, between very different scales. And the interesting thing is that down there at the bottom, when you start talking about microscopy, you need a whole lot of interesting, you know, parameters, a whole lot of things. At the top, when you're starting to talk about the behavior, you need to know a whole lot of, you know, non-universal detailed things. But in the middle somewhere, you know, that's where the universal series live, which is, we don't know that many, and there is, you know, 5 parameters that need to specify the entire, you know, the entire one. And so, you know, maybe the hope might be that this ladder would sort of start wide, become narrow, and then start, you know, become wide at the top again.
Possibly. Do we have any other burning questions that by people who think that the question is not going to be addressed in the talk? So all I'm really saying is the scientific method makes us look at runs, right? But we've seen enough of the runs. People have established rules at all these different levels, right? Let's start walking up and down this ladder, because that's what the biological information is doing. That's the point. It's a second kind of problem. It's a second kind of way of thinking, right? Not just to find deterministic behavior at the level you're investigating. Like, with the, whatever your level is, you're investigating is the mesoscopic. You're adjusting macroscopic conditions, rat in the box or whatever, to get deterministic behavior at the mesoscopic level and to marginalize microscopic behavior because microscopic variables, because that disrupts your mesoscopic rules. So we've constructed all these runs. Right? Let's walk up and down the rungs and let's do that because that's what the biological information is doing. And my claim is that the computational and adaptive power of biology comes exactly from this interlevel information flows, not from the computation at any given level.
They're trying it all the time, the language gene, the so-and-so molecule.
Yes. It's a world of fundamentalists, and I'm fundamentally opposed to fundamentalists.
Are you going to give us a definition of level, or are you saying there is no level?
I'm just going to go on and describe a whole bunch of them, because otherwise this is just a philosophy. Shall I go on? Okay. So the main point is very simple. If you look at the difference in state vectors in machine and nature, I think this is the difference. In computers and in the machines we build, we try to get the degrees of freedom to behave in deterministic macroscopic ways. So that and deterministic macroscopic things which are operating within a level are demonstrated by horizontal lines. And so in a computer you can imagine 2 sets of horizontal lines. One is the Hamiltonian that moves the electrons around, and the other one is the logic functions which move the gate around. But the electrons don't really have a very interesting life. They're just there to implement the bits, and they're screened off from the rest of the computation. Whereas if you look in biology, say, spikes which arrive at postsynaptic densities, they actually talk to proteins, and the proteins talk back up to the spikes by a coherent activation. So in biology, the general rule is no horizontal arrows, upward and downward arrows. That is really like the single main point of the whole talk. And so I draw these like little, these arrows here are like structural arrows which take a microscopic state vector to a macroscopic state vector, and these are causal arrows which take you from T to T plus 1. It's a cartoon, right? Discrete time, discrete levels. It's just a cartoon. I know it's wrong, but it's just something to really set the point, set it down, the theme of the talk down very simply.
Well, can you say something and see if you agree or disagree so that I make sure I understand?
Yes.
So computer is maybe not quite the right analogy because it was man-built and it's, you know, it's easier to do things this way because there is a department, you know, at Intel that works with the logic design and the level of bits, and there's a department that works at optimizing transistors and electron level, and it's hard for them to communicate. So most of the communication is within the department. So that's all true, but if you take a natural phenomena, you know, in physics, there is not such separation between levels a priori. That separation between levels is a result of our analysis
yes.
of nature
yes.
and we introduce it.
So physics is a subfield of biology, so it's on this side.
Something like that. Yeah. So but we introduce that consciously because we cannot cognitively understand things on all different levels.
Yes.
Then we have to restrict ourselves to some particular levels, and yes. then they have five variables to yes. consider, and then we can understand that. So it's not
correct.
The property of nature in any case. It's the property of our mind.
Exactly.
So
but we can also apply our minds to this. And this is what they did in renormalization group.
Property of our mind or our training?
Property of our mind.
What if we were trained differently?
I don't think it's possible because that's...
Should I just
well, we can go into evolutionary things, but I think that's how our minds evolved to figure out
in
who is what to whom in small
right.
groups. Of
okay, I think we're going to keep going.
So, when do you exclude emergence in the computer? I mean...
Well, in a physical computer, a cosmic ray is an example of emergence, right? It's something that disrupts the Turing rule-based behavior, but the abstraction which the computer is trying to approximate is deterministic at the bit level. Otherwise, there isn't emergence. Emergence is defined here as something which disrupts the horizontal arrow. It's something coming from beneath, and it disrupts it.
But I can simulate emergence in the computer, so and that would be emergence.
Yeah, then you're doing everything up here. All your simulations happening up here, and there's no emergence from the electrons. So just there's a lot of stuff to come, so I want to push a little bit. My background is really in machine learning. And machine learning is concerned with mappings between these vector spaces, and there's some of them that they've worked out, we've solved more or less, and there's some of them which we haven't. So, for example, we've worked out how to build really good single-layer, square matrix transforms, which are adapted to the statistics of the inputs. An example is independent component analysis, and many of the extensions which have been produced. And we can also build over-complete mappings from lower-dimensional spaces to higher-dimensional spaces using sparse coding techniques. We still don't know how to build undercomplete mappings, how to throw information away. We still haven't solved that problem in a beautiful way. There are many solutions which don't solve it completely. But basically the problem here is that we don't know what information to throw away, right? If you have an information theoretic system, we don't know what's good information and what's bad information, right? So we don't know what to throw away. We don't even know that. We're really really in a pretty primitive state. There's some interesting work on multi-layer networks, deep belief networks, which are multi-layer density estimation schemes. Everything here I'm talking about is unsupervised learning, because you can cast all of the supervised learning stuff into an unsupervised learning framework. We've got some results on temporal networks, Coleman filters, hidden Markov models. This says dynamic phase. Which is the full temporal density estimation scheme that you would get if you were doing the full temporal density estimation. The main thing which is not solved at all is sensory motor. We really don't have any good unsupervised learning rules which go in loops where we have creatures behaving in the environment. So one of the things I like to say I never understand why that happened. That has happened to me before in open office, and I don't understand why. Like it refuses to say on that slide.
Switch levels.
What?
It's going up and down. It's going up and down.
Just hold it. What's the solution here?
It must be time somehow. Tony, I thought reinforcement learning suffices to do sensory motor learning in many cases. You wouldn't consider that?
I don't consider reinforcement learning because, in general, if you go to a robot lab, they don't know what reward function to put in, right? So you need an extra utility function that comes out from outside. There's a difference between the reward-based phenomena which we see in biology, which is the dopamine system, which are synapses, within the brain, which have a plastic connection to the sensory exterior, and the reinforcement learning framework, where a signal is applied continuously, like God saying good, bad, good, bad, good, bad, you know, which is a sort of like a magic wire that comes in from outside. So I don't find the reinforcement, even though the mathematics is rather beautiful, I don't find it a compelling framework for understanding biological adaptation.
But there are simple examples where sensory motor problems get solved by that. It's a matter of scale, I guess, is what you're saying.
There are simple examples if you have a reward function. But mostly, it's like supplying a fitness function to your AI simulation, supplying a reward function to your robot. When you actually sit down and try to do it, you have to pull these functions out of thin air. What we really have is a system in interaction with its environment. And if I could get this computer to stay on this slide, which is really freaky, actually. Okay, I'll just have to write the equation.
You have an automatic transition.
Why didn't you go into that remote?
What?
This slide remote.
Go into the edit mode.
Yeah, you're right. So you can see that.
Kill the left hand and kill them.
It's not perfect, but better.
Stable.
So all that this slide says, it's just to make a conceptual point, we could argue about this for 10 minutes as well, is that when you differentiate the chaos divergence between a model and a model distribution and a data distribution, which what you're always doing in density estimation, you get two terms, right? This is the chaos divergence between a distribution, data distribution T, model distribution Q, differentiate with respect to a weight value, you get two terms. One is the likelihood gradient, which is the sensory problem. That's adapting the model to fit the world. Another one is a term you get, which is how the synapse in the brain or the weight or whatever changes the data distribution. If you had an analytically known and tractable world, differentiable world, you could differentiate the external world with respect to this parameter and work out how a little bit of learning would change your data distribution. For example, if you're trying to model the statistics of natural images, you could shut your eyes and say it's dark, right? And this is in fact the kind of thing that we do. We change the world to fit our model. And I think that's half of the density estimation scheme that biology is actually involved in. And that's the term where you start to get the difference between meaningful information and not meaningful information, in my opinion, because meaningful information is for example something that enables me. If I'm too cold and the model that my cells have is not working very well. My cells aren't working very well because the proteins are not going at the right speed. I know I can go into somewhere where it's warm, and I can get the model of my proteins to be accurate again because I've performed some action to put myself in a situation where the expectations of my biological system are not violated. So I think that's part of. I think there is a way to think about the sensory motor loop in a unsupervised way by this extra term, and this is just a conceptual point. I'm not claiming that we can really differentiate this, but it's just to say that we can get meaningful action without having to posit something like a reward or something like that. Sarah?
So I just want to make sure I understand this. So Q is an internal model, and
yes.
W are the parameters of that model.
Yes.
It could be synaptic constraints, or it could be
yes.
level of expressions of
yes.
different
yes.
factors. Okay. So usually in a learning algorithm, we think of changing those parameters to which parameterize Q.
Mm-hmm.
So we have terms in the gradients, like the second term.
Right.
D log Q respect to W.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying is that you need also another term.
Yes.
Which is the fact that it's like learning by queries in some sense.
That once
I have the model, I look at the data
mm-hmm.
according to that model. And if I change the parameters of that model, that will change how I look at the data.
Yes.
Is what you're saying?
Yes.
And the data being external.
No, he's saying it actually changes the data. Not how you look at it.
No, yeah, it changes the data.
Well, that's in the world. No, it changes the distribution of the data, which
yes.
means it changes how, by acting in the world in different ways, I can focus or capture different
I can de-emphasize, you know, I happen to believe that the world exists whether I look at it or not, but mm-hmm. maybe that's a philosophical point of view. So there is the world with its distribution. So the only thing I can change is what I emphasize or de-emphasize in my looking at the world. I can, if P of X is the distribution of data as it is in the external world, I cannot change that, but I can change, I can filter that distribution through my attention, through
it's
my thoughts, through my
eyes.
It's
true, but what I really mean by P of X is really the probability distribution of signals landing on that point of sensory. I'm not talking about trying to estimate some...
So it's not a statistic of the natural world, it's a statistics of the input, which therefore I can change.
You can also, you're also saying you can change the statistics of the world, right? I mean, I do an action and I've changed the consequences of the events of the world, the
event
of the heat, the apples off the tree.
Yes, and in doing so, I'm changing the probability of different sensory input for other creatures.
But the derivative is taken in respect to synoptic weights, not the firing rate.
this, first of all, this derivative here is completely abstract. This is just three lines of calculus. But I could imagine that this is a synaptic weight which changes. You know, I change one weight from 2 to 3, and that changes the probability distribution of what lands on my receptor. Something like that. In some way, it may not change it very well. Okay, let's go back to the. So I want to push through this. This is old stuff. Don't ask me questions about ICI. I've been giving talks about that for forever. But I just want to show you, we were talking about development. And after 10 years, this is still the state of the art, in I believe, in learning, you know, in trying to learn in an activity dependent way from natural images and the things like receptor fields. So, with a couple of assumptions, independence of sparseness and 2D topography, there's been a slew of work which was really successful from about 96 to about 2001, and then we got stuck. We were able to explain simple cells, complex cells, and V1 type topography, kind of like an orientation problem with the continuous variation in spatial frequency, orientation, and position of cells. From high frequency and to low frequency singularities, didn't we? And it was all done just using pixels, right? We didn't put in any of those parameters of the scene to begin with. So it's a very simple-minded explanation of V1. It's a matrix between pixels and the V1 representation, but it does still capture some of the features of the area V1. When we got stuck on trying to build two layers, and the reason for that is we can't calculate the gradient of the partition function very well, I decided to go ahead and look at the spiking case, right? Because this has always been sitting in the background puzzling us. So we can do exactly the same math that we did in the Infomax ICA case. We can do the same thing to spiking networks and say, here you have like 3 spiking neurons forming some input time to the 3x3 into an entire network, and they're getting that into 3 output spiking neurons. And you can build a big matrix of Jacobians for the sensitivity of all the output timings with respect to the input timings, and you can optimize the long determinant of that matrix, which makes the network as sensitive as possible to its multivariate spiking input. So this is trying to get information through a spiking network where every spike is treated as kind of like a sacred little coding event. And the way it really works is, you know, twiddle one spike back and forward in the input spikes. You're adding up EPSPs and sort of spike response model into a fire type model. And there's a pointer here, right? My arm's not so long. So if you move this spike back and forward, then you're moving this EPSP back and forward, which moves this ramp up and down, up and down, which moves this EPSP back and forward, which moves the output timing back and forward. So you can calculate using implicit differentiation how changing one input timing in integrating fire network will change the output timing. And you can build a big matrix of those. And I thought, great, if we can do that. And this is what this is the insight that I got in a conversation with Lucas Parent. So we went ahead and wrote a paper on it for NIP 4 years ago, and the journal version of it is still waiting to appear. It's a substantially longer and more complete study. than the conference paper, but the unfortunate thing about it was that this gave us the most complicated unsupervised learning rule ever derived, in which to change one WIJ in this feedforward integrated fire network with the same... Ooh.
There is a hissing
problem. I have a very interesting relationship with technology.
Things break
around me. What's that?
Is there a linearity? Is the addition linear? Or?
Yeah, this is basically Gerstner's spike response model. And we've calculated the Jacobian for a network of these guys. And we're optimizing two things. Oh, here goes again, appearing and disappearing. Ah, very good. Fantastic. This gives us... how am I doing with the time here? Yeah, I'm going to have to really speed up, because all the interesting stuff still to come. This is relatively old work. But what it gives us is a learning rule for the weights, which for a WIJ, which involves the pseudo-inverse transpose of the pseudo-inverse transpose of the Jacobian matrix of how every single spike input spike in all the inputs affects every single input output spike. So you have to invert a matrix for how every input timing affects every output timing across the whole network. It's the most global thing you could possibly imagine. There's no way this can be a operating head rule. And then there's an extra term here which constrains the firing rates, otherwise you would just get lots and lots of output spikes. So what went wrong in the reasoning here? So this is where the talk changes direction to the interesting stuff. What went wrong was that we were trying to, say, derive STDP from the point of view of a feed-forward network, where we have inputs coming in here, and we have the readout at the SOMA. So what I'm going to be bashing for the rest of the talk is the feedforward information processing paradigm, even though I've been working in it for a decade. We completely ignore the feedback from the SOMA back onto the synapse. The plasticity calculation occurs at the synapse. It doesn't occur at the SOMA. The readout of the spiking activity network doesn't occur at the SOMA. It occurs at the synapse, which is why I asked Nietzsche during his talk when he said the reason for dendrites is to conduct spikes from input to output, and I always have in my mind, well, what about this thing here, which we miss in our feedforward analysis, the feedback back from the SOMA down to the synapse. And if you put that in, then, well, what you have is a mapping between neurons and synapses. So the mapping that the nervous system, the feedforward mapping, if you want, that the nervous system is performing, it's not a mapping between neurons and neurons, it's a mapping between neurons and synapses, and that's a downward arrow, right? So that's where the talk starts to take off in this direction of the main theme which I'm going to be talking about. You have neurons that talk to synapses. It's an overcomplete mapping. If you've got n of these, you're going to have like order n squared of these, or at least 1,000 times as many, which is what we have in the brain.
But isn't learning rule just the way the form of this? Learning rule isn't it the form of this arrow from neurons to synapses? I mean, the learning rule which you wrote on the slide. Which
was, yes.
Isn't that the form of arrow between?
That's the learning rule, but I'm now talking about the thing which we want to optimize as being this overcomplete mapping between a state vector at the neural level and a state vector at the synaptic level. So instead of mapping from N to N neurons, we're mapping from N to, well, we're mapping from, instead of mapping from 10 to 11 to 10 to 11 neurons, right, in a recurrent network, we're mapping from 10 to 11 neurons to 10 to the 14 readout variables at synapses. So we're doing an overcomplete mapping to a more microscopic space. That's where the
so there's recurrent neurons have time and synapses
don't. Well, okay. So what you have to this is very cartoon-like, but what you have to imagine is that these are spike timings, right? And these are state variables sampled at the synapse at the times when spikes come in, right?
Yeah, but the synaptic efficacy presumably changes slower.
Yes.
Than the spiking.
Yes. So there's two things. One is the mapping which we're optimizing, and the other is the learning rule, right? Like we had the Jacobian of the network, and we have the learning rule. I'm trying to say that the Jacobians of the networks are these inter-level mappings.
I'm having a little bit of trouble when you say neurons talk to synapses. So either I would ask you to change, can you change at synapses, or do you want to define synapses? Or we can do this later.
There's some synapses.
Yeah, but I think you're mixing, to my ear, you're mixing, I get confused. So if you say synapse, do you mean the presynaptic, postsynaptic?
Oh, I mean the postsynaptic density, mostly. I mean, you know, look at it. Here's pre and here's post, and there's some little space, very little space in between. This is the little computational engine that I'm going to be focusing on, the postsynaptic density. And so what I'm imagining is that there's NMDA receptors here, and there's voltage-dependent L-type channels around, and that they're combining, producing different kinds of calcium signal, which are triggering different kinds of cascades of kinases and phosphatases, and that's leading to the plasticity machinery where vesicles with NMDA and AMPA receptors are getting channels to the plasma membrane from Golgi or ER, something like that. But all of the things, all of what we do in neural nets is just to treat this whole complexity as like a WIJ, and that's I think the thing that we need to get away from. Because really, there's lots of these protein complexes in dendrites, and they really have this complicated. They have all kinds of stuff happening in here. So if you looked at one of these postsynaptic densities, and let's say we had a vesicle fusion here, and you've got a little EPSP that comes along here, and there's some voltage and calcium spread to an adjacent synapse, then this adjacent synapse has got exactly the same thing as what we saw in the neuron to synapse case, in the sense that each of the molecules here has got different voltage and calcium sensitivity. So if I get a little bump of voltage or a little bump of calcium coming here, this guy, each of these guys over here hears that signal in a different way. So again, we have a downward arrow. In this case, we have a downward arrow from synapses, from protein complexes, i.e. this protein complex here, to a more microscopic space, which is the individual proteins over here. So this is the pattern. This is the general pattern that I'm trying to push in this whole talk. When you have things split up into modules, then the place where you're reading out signals, even if you think about, I'm talking words to you now, right? You can't hear my individual spikes, but each of your neurons is doing something different with my words, right? So that in itself is a downward pattern, right? So these downward arrows are universal, and this structure is repeated in biology, where things that are far away, modules which are far away, send lumped activity to another module, and then the parts of that module take it apart and respond to it in different ways. So just as a spike from a neuron talks to synapses, so does an EPSP from a synapse talks to individual macromolecules. And we'd like to iterate that all the way down into the cytoplasm and all the way up through the anatomical structures of the brain. And that's the main message of the talk. So the, Ilya. Ooh, OpenOffice is not doing a good job with that one. But, yeah.
It's somewhat aside, but so if the synapses talk to each other, which can in fact would have one virus line?
The synapses are talking. A synapse is talking to another synapse's macromolecules, not to the synapse as a whole. That's the message. There's a downward arrow there. Just as I'm talking to all your different neurons, and as a neuron's talking to all... Right.
So, it means, again, that the inputs to a particular neuron from two other neurons are not independent. But it's going to depend on the inputs from other neurons. So this will presumably change a lot the various learning rules that you would need to develop to learn in the spiking networks.
I'm sorry, I got distracted. So this is a figure from Morgan Chang, which shows a schematic of the postsynaptic density. And within the postsynaptic density, you have calcium microdomains, which are possibly in the order of 20 nanometers. maybe twice the width of the NMDA receptor, which means each of these proteins is so what I'm arguing here is that calcium is to the postsynaptic density or to this protein complex what voltage is to the dendrites as a whole. It's a communication signal that's going back and forth between these different proteins. So it's not like there's like one calcium signal from the dendrite. It's literally like if calcium comes through here, it hits, and this guy here has got a protein sitting sideways. This guy here is oriented in such a way that some of the proteins on the inside of the plasma membrane are kind of hanging out over the pore, then these guys will get exactly hit by individual calcium ions, and they'll be able to change their conformation as a consequence. So the detailed spatial organization within the synapse and in the postsynaptic density is a little machine for a spatially varying calcium signal, just as the synapses themselves form a dendritic machine for varying voltage levels.
Can I get one question about dynamic range? So, I mean, we imagine that voltage is sensitive to some analog variable within a dendritic tree or
whatever.
Yes. Right. And calcium level surely also has some analog range, but single molecule presumably can maybe detect a few levels, maybe calcium present, calcium not present, or calcium above some amount present, or maybe a few bits, and not some very large dynamical range and analog values. So that probably hamstrings the calculation we can perform.
Probably. I mean, these kind of things always make. I mean, for example, if we think about photoreceptors trying to calculate some light level, right? I don't think they're trying to calculate some light level in general, because you can have a photoreceptor in the cat in the dark responding to a single photon. So it sort of depends. So always when we think this is these guys are trying to calculate some calcium level. Well, no, they're not. Actually, they're just getting hit by calcium ions and changing the conformation as a consequence. So I think we always have to resist the temptation to say what the system is trying to calculate. It's a physical system which is just doing what it's doing. See what I mean?
Right, but if you're proposing it as a machinery for doing certain kinds of learning, then it has some limitations. Physical limitations can impinge on the calculations.
But the limitations are defined only in terms of subjective concepts, which are usually coming from the experimenter. That's my point. Just in the same case where the neurons are trying to estimate some orientation of this bar, and the way in which they're not doing it is called their unreliability. Well, actually, the neurons are just doing what they're doing, right? And if it happens to be purported to be correlated with a whole bunch of other things, then that's what that neuron is doing as well. It's the same thing for these macromolecules. If they happen to be picking up vibrations in the water or tyrosine residues or anything like that, and that's messing with what you think is an estimation of some calcium level, well, that's because you have the concept that it's estimating the calcium level, and what it's really doing is what it's doing.
So your claim basically is that there's no holographic principle in neuroscience.
No holographic principle?
In neuroscience.
I'd have to know what that means.
It means that we can reconstruct behavior of highly dimensional system from lower dimensional space. Like, you could predict the positions of proteins from just the activities of neurons. Right? And then activities of proteins become sort of byproducts of what you can predict them. Than the real variable, state variables, activity of the neuron, right? If protein expression levels and concentrations, they are all products of activities of neurons, mm-hmm. then you can remove them from your equations, right? And only write equations for activities of neurons.
I could do that.
Yes. So you're saying that you cannot?
No, you can't.
Okay.
In general.
Which means that there's no holographic principle in neuroscience. That's what you're stating.
Okay, well, I'm happy to put it that way, if that's the way you want to put it.
So, Tony, I thought you promised us to teach how to move between the levels.
No, I didn't promise. I'm basically trying to make a bunch of didactic points and finish with 13 conclusions on the last slide, which will cause a real argument, except we only have 2 minutes left to do it. This is you could go down into the cytoplasm and look at how crowded it is, and if people think that that everything washes out down here because of Brownian motion, well then you should consider the fact that the average distance between proteins is 10 nanometers, and that they have these polarized outside, so that you can have metabolites, small molecules, having constrained diffusion, and really even the cytoplasm is a packed machine type. Even the cytoplasm is in the machine phase. It's not like, and this is when you have these measuring these enzyme reactions, the proteins are usually on average that far apart, and this is 100 nanometers. But this is how they really are. Right? This square corresponds to this square here. So this is what it's really like down there.
But this is not
E. coli.
These are all different proteins.
Yes, these are proteins, ribosomes, and
molecules are that far apart.
Right. Right. These are. This is a sort of random assembly of protein, ribosome, and nucleic acids, and it's just a depiction of how packed the cytoplasm is. So think about this as you like your electron micrograph from yesterday. It kind of looks like it, right? This is as detailed and as structured and organized in the cytoplasm as your electron micrograph.
Oh, you don't really know that.
This is what, if you go and read trends in biochemical sciences instead of trends in neurosciences, you see the same debates that we're having, signal, noise, organization, exactly the same debates that we're having about spike timing and probability of release of vesicles, about reliability, as opposed to, experimental uncertainty. You can see all the same issues operating in the cytoplasm as you see operating in systems in neuroscience.
No, no, but it's not
scale invariance of the reliability debate.
Right, but it's not proven that all those molecules are arranged on a lattice in some particular way that they can work on it that way, right?
These are thrown down randomly, and right. This is a paper from 1999 by E. coli. This is the drawing, right? If you actually look at, I think I have one actually. If you look at pictures, this is a picture of dixicillium with actin filaments. And I can't remember, some of these are proteins and some of them are ribosomes, but it's pretty ordered. And that's how you're getting all
these. No, I would argue this is disordered.
What's that?
This is disordered.
No, this is highly ordered.
But,
yeah, it's
well, to give you some concrete examples, the calcium channels that mediate vesicle release are right next door to the top docking sites. Pfizer showed this. And they're arranged in a little row. They're not disordered. They're put exactly where they're most effective. Mitochondria are positioned in cells where there's the highest rate of energy consumption. There's a lot of order in there. It just doesn't look like the sort of things we're used to. It doesn't look like the sea.
Right. And when you go up to the level of the brain, this is an epileptic patient at UCSF. With the fractal vascular network, and they can do ECOG recording up from the surface of the cortex. So you start to think about the level that we've been talking about the relationships between oscillations at different scales. The gamma scale may be like that, maybe a millimeter. The theta scale might be like that. Theta is, gamma is 40 hertz and above. Theta is like 4 to 7. Delta is like, say, 1 to 4, right? And if you look at this paper from these papers from Lakatos and Charlie Schroeder and Ryan Milton and Pascal Priest, what you see is that when you look in, this is auditory cortex of monkey spontaneous activity time frequency plot, and you see that you see the peak of delta and then delta going up and then going down. What you see is amplitude of theta coming on at certain phase of the delta oscillation. And this is exactly shown here. The phases of the delta oscillation followed by that, amplitude of theta going up and down. And then the ECOG experiment, which was done with that brain I showed you, and this is in Berkeley from Bob Knight's lab, they look at the theta oscillation and they find that gamma amplitude is correlated with the theta oscillation. Gamma amplitude occurs at a certain phase of the theta oscillation, and that runs all the way up to 200 hertz. So gamma reliability up to 200 hertz, that doesn't mean you have cells oscillating at 200 hertz. That means that the spike chatter, which is correlated in such a way that there's a strong 200 hertz component. And so you have, and then if you go on to the gamma to spike coupling, which is the Pascal Fried story, that spikes are most likely to occur at a certain phase of the gamma cycle, which is kind of getting into some of the things we're talking about in Ilya's talk. So what you have is the notion then that there are these delta networks, theta networks, and gamma networks, which are a hierarchy of assemblies with different spatial scales corresponding to different frequencies in the EEG or LFP or current source density spectrum, and that there is this phase amplitude coupling as the downward arrows, and then the hypothesis is that there's synchrony or gamma assemblies forming, which then will create theta bursts through the thalamus, which will reset more global networks. So I really should speed up because, you know, it's been going for a while, right? And I think we want to get to this slide at the end, because really what I'm saying, oh, this is also a very interesting one. Charlie Schroeder, Charlie Schroeder's lab, Lakatos paper, Science in Paris. He's been discovering that there are, these are current source density analysis. In the monkey V1 supragranular infragranular layers, when you're attending to a visual stimulus and you have these visual, you have like flashes and you have beeps, and they're aperiodic, but like roughly periodic. They come on and off like, you know, less than maybe 400 to 800 milliseconds would be the variation in the intervals here. But what the monkey ends up doing is creating these current sources and sinks in the supragranular layer two and three, probably from layer one input from auditory cortex. And when you're attending to visual, it's exactly antiphase to when you're attending to the auditory. So you're attending to visual, you get higher amplitude, you get a higher amplitude delta oscillation coming in on the supragranular layer, and it's high out of phase from the case when you're attending to auditory. And so that means that when you're right here, when you're supposed to respond to the visual task, you have like a source. But when you're attending to the auditory task, but recording from V1, then you have you're actually in the down phase of this delta oscillation. So that means that these delta oscillations are in training. Are basically a mechanism of attention. The delta oscillations are just as when you're in the up phase of the gamma oscillation, a spike can send you over a threshold. So when you're in the up phase of the delta oscillation, a gamma assembly can be ready to form. So we have these cross couplings across the frequency spectrum, and these oscillations are performing. Putting the network in ready state, basically.
It's a correlation.
It's a correlation. Yeah, I'm telling you.
It's not a causation.
It's a story, right. Well, no, I wouldn't be calling it. It's a correlation.
You say it's a mechanism that implies that. I mean, it could also be just an epiphenomenon.
Right. If you think oscillations are an epiphenomenon, then we're an epiphenomenon as well. And the US government is an epiphenomenon because it's just made from the activities of people. Right? Epiphenomenon is a very tricky word philosophically. Right? It's the nine causal part to a higher order construct. And everything that you're looking at is a higher order construct. So oscillations are no more epiphenomena than spikes. Spikes are the collective activities of macromolecules. Oscillations are the collective activity of spikiness, the collective activity of membrane currents. So what I'm imagining is that, you know, these top layers up here, they are receiving spiking input, but what they're really hearing is the roar of the crowd in A1, right? So in A1 you have all this detailed spiking, but V1 just gets to hear going, and it's going whoa, 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 right like that, and that's what's coming in on the dendrites. I'm not saying that this is happening through actual field effects in the tissue, though that probably is having an effect. People are starting to show things like that. But even if you don't have these hepatic effects, you still have to talk about these oscillations as having causal powers because they are the collective summary of spiking activity. So the epiphenomena thing is a confusing thing for physiologists, but it shouldn't be because nothing should ever be called an epiphenomenon because everything is an epiphenomenon. Everything's made from like smaller things, unless there's something funny going on. So the summary is, in the brain, calcium is a network of proteins, of voltages, network of synapses, what spike timing is to small networks of neurons, what oscillation phase is to larger networks. And of course it's more complicated than that, but this is a cartoon view, and these are not separate levels of organization, but the same thing expressed at different spatiotemporal resolutions, as just like in, say, a wavelet transform. And, you know, for example, if you could knew all the calcium flows in my brain, you could write down what words were coming out of my mouth, probably. So it's really just a way of describing things at different scales.
Okay, so can we start discussing?
Yes, this is the discussion slide. This is the consequences of looking.
I want to discuss what you just. I want to go back one.
Oh.
Because this.
Well, it's written here in number 13. All processes of the same thing express a different resolution.
But this is like. So this is fine. All processes the same thing express a different resolution. But then the question that arises is at which level do we need to discuss it? And you made a point at the very beginning against discussing them at a fixed level.
No, I'm not against it.
This is a little bit like David Gross saying everything is made out of quarks. I know everything is made out of quarks, however,
I don't agree.
No, strings, sorry. I'm sorry. the wrong era, the wrong Nobel Prize. A condensed matter physicist would argue that he's very happy to describe the quantum Hall effect without worrying about strings and thinking about electrons, right? So for the phenomena that he wants to describe, the electron description is a very fine description, and he doesn't need to go back and say, oh, if you could read my strings, you would know what the electron is doing, and then you would explain the quantum Hall effect. So there is an analogy there where, although this is true, that it's always the same thing, you could say the electron is an epiphenomenon of the strings, but it's perfectly valid for a large class of problems to describe the world.
But Sarah, I disagree with your characterization of what I'm saying.
Oh.
Firstly, I never said that we shouldn't build the rungs of the ladder, right? That's a necessary step. You have to know where the rungs are before you start walking up and down, right? But then to say that what I'm saying is something like what David Grote says, which everything should be collapsed down to the microscopic, that's another kind of fundamentalism, which I also disagree with. Because what the important point about this is to think about the flows between different levels of the system, right? It's to move from looking at the rungs to working out what is the flow of information between the different levels of the system and what are the physical mechanisms that are implementing that. For example, spikes arriving at synapses and phases of oscillations controlling amplitudes of other oscillations.
But just to follow up Sarah's question, I mean, okay, it's true that if you did change the masses of some of the fundamental particles, it would have a trickle-down effect and all the condensed matter systems and so on. But why do we want to understand that? I mean, we just want to understand condensed matter for what it is, and we want to understand high energy for what it is. You're saying that the main thing that we should really study is how if you change the fundamental particle masses, that's going to affect...
No, I'm saying study inter-level information flow if you want to understand biology. That's what I'm saying. I'm not trying to say let's collapse all the levels to the bottom, and I'm not trying to say you shouldn't look at individual levels, because looking at individual levels is what enabled us to build this ladder that we're going to now walk up and down. But I'm saying that we've got enough information now, and I tried to give some of it. I didn't do a very good job, but I tried to give some of the scenarios which are where you can see where these inter-level information flows are. And I say, now we build an inter-level theory, because that's what they already did in physics for scale invariant systems. And the challenge in biology is to do it for scale systems which have particular scales. And that is a theoretical physics, empirical biology, mathematical physics question.
Maybe I misunderstood your comment that if I knew all the details about your current calcium flows, I would be able to understand the words as saying, this is what you need to do in order
No, I would never say something like that. I mean, otherwise we couldn't get to talk about all these wonderful macroscopic phenomena, which is what we're talking about all month, right?
Yeah.
So, in some ways I think these things are extremely obvious, right? It's just a little hard to get your brain around. But if you really do start to think this way, you end up thinking about everything differently. And that's why I've got 14 different bullet points there. All the way from that modularity implies that information flows up and down, not horizontal. That the micro is an overcomplete space in which information can be stored. That equation is a macroscopic boundary condition on microscopic activity. That an answer or a memory is emergent from the microscopic. Instead of thinking of associative memory as a single flat level thing, where we have a neural state vector and a weight matrix, like in our type hippocampus models, let's think about establishing a boundary condition on the physical matter that creates a different emergence from the microscale. That's how I would like to think about associative memory, as a cross-level emergence. That emergence into awareness, right? I don't use the C word, I'll use the A word, right? It's probably emergence from the microscopic. It's emergence into the realm of report, because that's all we can ever do, right? We can't access consciousness, we can only access report. That noise, you know, even yesterday when I hear David Kleinfeld say, oh, you have to have all these synapses there because they're noisy, you know, you have to have multiple inputs for reliability. I think all this thinking is like completely wrong-headed. Noise is an experimental concept. It relates to experimental uncertainty. It's not something that's defined intrinsically in the system. Even to the level of physics where you don't know the difference between whether it's something moving around, whether it's part of the free energy term or the heat in thermodynamics. Even that is subjective. And if you go and read the philosophy of the foundations of system mechanics and thermodynamics, you find them arguing about that, right? Whether or not it's Maxwell's even type talk, whether or not some motion is heat or free energy entirely depends on the degrees of freedom that you have coupling into the system, right? So noise, the signal noise distinction, the free energy heat distinction, these are things which are subjective and don't have an intrinsic relationship to reality. Reality, the ding and dick, whatever that is, right? Then other things, control. Control is just a macroscopic boundary condition that identifiable at one level. It can be disruptible by emergence and be disruptible also by some higher order boundary conditions. What appear as loops are actually inter-level interactions. The sensory motor loop, as we go from neurons to outputs, words, to other words coming from you back down to my neurons, this is an inter-level interaction. It's an interaction between the neural network and the social network. So all the things we think of as loops are actually, you know, conjunctions or products of these upward and downward arcs of flows of information between different levels. I already addressed the concept of reward, which I find to be an impoverished, agent-centered concept, which probably, if you're a social psychologist, and we're not looking at rats in a box, but rather groups of creatures interacting, would completely disappear, and you would have to have some kind of social matrix theory. Then we have interesting cases where there is decoupling of levels, like when we fall asleep, right? When we fall asleep, we decouple ourselves from the social matrix. Maybe the reason for that is that it's a chance for molecular networks and neural networks to converse with each other without getting interfered with by the social network. So the lever density estimation scheme is occurring, you know, at those two levels has to recalibrate itself in order that you don't end up with epilepsy, right? Because if you don't sleep, you end up going epileptic, the system becomes unstable. So I think that just thinking in this inter-level way, and I don't have a theory, I don't have a model, this is just a set of ideas, right? It's just some provocations in a sense. I think that all the things we think about start to look different when we think in this inter-level way. And then finally, you know, people want to argue about nature and nurture. I don't think there's any friction between explanations at different levels when you look at it this way, because what you really, you know, for example, somebody trying to work out whether something's self-organization or evolution, right? Well, evolution is something that's happening up here at the species predator-prey level. Lockhart Volterra equations or something like that. It's something which is, people argue for years and years about where evolution operates. Does it operate at the gene level? Does it operate at the population of creatures level? And then the current theorists are saying, well, it's operating in all levels. And what they're really saying is, well, this is some population drift effects that we find way up here beyond beyond the social level up at the ecological level. These are just some macroscopic equations which are coarse-grained versions of all this other stuff which is sitting down here. So there's no conflict between evolution and self-organization any more than there's a conflict between the highest part of the wavelet pyramid description and the lowest part of it. So, I don't know. Everything looks different to me when you start to look at it this way. And I think there's a scientific challenge here to get off the rungs and start walking, right? And what it really boils down to me is to try to unify microscopic physics, biology, and the modern theory of probabilistic learning, density estimation, the life of these observations. And so I don't think that we should have the word unfortunately here in Ed Callaway's quotation. I think that it's amazing and wonderful that nature has this diversity. And I think that this perspective of looking at it from multiple levels is diametrically opposed to the von Neumann point of view, which is implicit in our field, that biology is made of wet, unreliable things. I think that I challenge you to draw the place on that levels diagram where there is not meaningful emergence from the microscale. Right? Show me where it is. Because if you can't show me where it is, then we are not talking about the point of von Neumann view. We're talking about something which is precisely organized down through all the scales, and there's meaningful information flowing from the top to the bottom and the bottom to the top, and that's what's happening in biology. So this should alert us to a different set of questions. Are there invariant characteristics in inter-level information flows? Is there a multi-resolution density estimation scheme involved? That's my intuition. I don't know what I really didn't get anywhere on it. Is there a connection to the kinds of scale invariant multi-level theories that have come about in physics, for example, the renormalization group, which is also a relationship between activity at different scales, but those scales are behaving in a very simple way, like scale invariant systems and coarse graining and things like that. In biology, we have much more complicated coarse graining functions, the dendrites, the axons. And then finally, this is the most radical thing that you could ask about this whole point of view. Are levels interdefined? Now that is a question which challenges reductionism itself, right? In all those figures, I had big state vectors, smaller state vectors, and I had upward arrows. We had determinism on the way up, and we have Markov on the way down. But if you read this book by Robert Laughlin and get into these debates between the particle physicists and the condensed matter physicists, you start to see that at the bottom level, when you're performing an experiment on some quantum system, it's not even clear what's really there, right? What comes out depends on the measurement. So, for example, you have these dualities in description between the properties of atoms in a lattice and the properties of vibrations on those lattice, and you can't work out which of these is more fundamental. This is duality, so there's a kind of a flipping occurring. So in the end, you know, there's probably something funny happening at the quantum level, which would demonstrate to us perhaps that reductionism is starting to look a bit shaky at the bottom. That's the end of the story.
So how does this square with a sort of equally microscopic view, which says that when components interact to produce a common output, you lose the identity of what the individual components are doing? So A equals B plus C, you give me, I don't know what B and C are. The action potential doesn't know which combination of synapses were activated to reach threshold. It just knows, and there's a billion different ways.
Right, that's implicit. That is exactly implicit in everything that I said, right? You don't know what my neurons are firing, but you know what's coming out of my mouth. That doesn't mean that my neuron firing is irrelevant, because that's affecting the distribution of all my proteins, right? So just because you're sitting over there and you hear the roar of the crowd in A1, you're in B1 and you hear the roar of the crowd in A1, and you just all you need to know is the phase and amplitude of that roar. That's all you care about in B1. That doesn't mean that over there in A1, each individual neuron is not doing something interesting and important in this little gamma network and its individual computations that are rearranging its own receptors. So again, it's a subjective thing. We do have, when you break up into modules, you have these modules treating the thing over here as being a sort of a lumped message, but over there, the individual components of the message are relevant.
But it's not.
So it's kind of like everything is sacred to something, right? That's kind of like the message here.
Well, I agree with that, but I mean, when you apply a receptive peak, you throw it away. A lot of what was out there in the picture.
Yes, well, that's what modules do.
Yeah.
But, you know, just because you're talking this way, I don't say I can now summarize Simon in terms of the words that come out of his mouth, because if you don't have that, all those rich internal processes, you're not going to be able to continue the conversation, you know.
But as we proceed as scientists, we can't keep track of all the variables and all the interactions of these complex systems. So we have to make abstractions
This goes back to the two points on the very first slide. I'm not saying we shouldn't build the runs, right? All I'm saying is when we get a strong enough picture of what the runs are, we have to start to look at the flow up and down the ladder, because that's what the power of the system is, giving the system its true power. I'm trying to identify a separate set of questions from the imperative to build a reduced description of dynamical phenomena. I'm trying to get a reduced description of interlevel interactions, if you like, right? Which is something that goes beyond the reduced description at one level. And that's implicit in all the work. Actually, all the experimental work is interlevel, you know? Every time you establish a macroscopic boundary condition, measure something mesoscopic, you are doing an interlevel interaction, you know? Putting behavioral constraints on the monkey, putting a voltage stamp on the membrane and measuring the individual. We're always doing interlevel, but can we stitch the thing together, right? It's a separate set of questions. It's a different set of theoretical questions.
Well, I was wondering, yes, I agree with everything you say, but I can make an effective interaction between neurons and neurons, which summarizes all this going down and going up.
Yes.
And I would like to know what I will be doing wrong if I just talk about neurons, which effectively interact with neurons.
What
problem I cannot solve?
And you can't solve the problem of interlevel information flows all the way up and down.
Well, I don't care. I only care about neurons.
Yes, but what? You only care about neurons. The person over there only cares about ion channels. So somebody else, the skull is reflecting barrier.
Yes, but the question is, it would be that when I talk about how neuron A influences neuron B, I'm doing something wrong in. I can't summarize it in effective
theory. No, I'm not saying.
I'm not saying
that building effective theories is a bad thing to do. I don't know how many times I have to say it, right? I wouldn't be able to draw these lines if it wasn't for all the wonderful work that has been done to identify the processes at each level. But when we start and we start to converge on a picture of all these different runs, it's time to start to find the invariance in the flows of information up and down. Because what's happening in biology is there's a very ordered and meaningful amplification of microscopic variables. I can't amplify a single photon at night into running away from a predator. Right? This is amplification from a quantum event to behavior. It's empirically demonstrated in 1972 by Bravo. That means that kind of thing is happening all over the biological tissue, not just at the photoreceptor. We have a system which is probably deriving its amazing power from this emergent phenomenon, which you will not get if you only study one level. But I'm not saying you shouldn't study one level, because when you study one level, you're really studying two, and you're really building the picture on which this next set of questions can be built,
And perhaps it is fair to say that many
in our community have done work in going up the ladder, right? People who ask, how do the, you know, how does a molecular
function
in synapses? But not so
genes
much
to behavior,
but not so much has been done, perhaps it's fair to say, in moving downwards, in understanding how phenomena at the higher level they construct and affect what is going on at the lower level. And we saw it during the weekend, and when we come back Monday morning, we'll have the answer.
There's
another question. So,
can you explain again your thesis 11, the dismissal of the word?
Sorry, what?
This is 11, I think it was, the dismissal of reward as a relevant notion.
The, my criticism of the notion of reward?
Yeah.
I think it's a, you know, for example, I go to Society of Neuroscience and there's Sebastian, so I'm talking to, you know, 30,000 people. And it was great and everything like that. But he says every synapse in the brain is trying to get as much dopamine as possible, which is, this is ridiculous. How many synapses in the brain have got dopamine receptors? You know, there are many, many different kinds of neuromodulator. The naive mapping of reinforcement learning theory onto the huge number of neuromodulators, which are very complicated actions in the brain, is a mapping that actually can't be done. So my main point about it, though, is that in reinforcement learning, we have an extra signal coming from outside. It's a special signal on a wire, which is called the reward signal. You don't really have that in biology. What you have is a sensory exterior, which is then converted into some special neural signals, which happen to be dopamine signals, which are very powerful in modulating behavior. But there isn't a mapping between the abstract mathematical theory of reinforcement learning and the physiological.
But you might need some sort of parameter telling, I mean, like you know, like you're mapping this to renormalization groups, like your you know, exchange energy, whatever. Some parameter that will set, because you know, the reward system of a human being or you know, rat are not the same. So you will need, I mean, you can call that.
You know, reward is a concept which evolved, which in classical conditioning evolved out of putting a rat in a very simple situation. And most deterministic behavior in biology comes from changing the experiment until the theoretical concept you've got in your head is suddenly appearing. Right? You put the rat in a whole bunch of rats, I don't know where the reward is, what's the matrix? You know, you have a matrix of interactions. Reward is an agent-centered concept. You know, I do not believe that there's any of us in this room that we're all optimizing our single scalar function. That's a much too naive way of thinking about the social metrics. Right? There's something much more complicated happening in social metrics, just as there are complicated things happening in the neural metrics. That would be like trying every synapse. There was this hedonic neuron hypothesis that every neuron would try to optimize it so that it's reward. It's inconsistent. You can't, in this multi-level framework, the notion of reward has to at the very least be generalized or to be seen as an emergent property of certain kinds.
But you will need something like that. I mean, yes. I think in terms of evolutionary terms, you know, the urge for sexual reproduction, you will have to set it as some sort of reward.
But it's not the only thing they're doing, like, you know, in fact, I didn't have kids.
Among other things, but, you know, just well, to be fair to Darwin. But.
I guess maybe it's fair to say that you would view reward as one of several drives or competing factors, and what you call the society for mind. I mean, if you think of the mind as a module of many different pieces that are trying to do many different things, and there's certainly some aspects of behavior that are reward-driven or motivated or, you know, reward-maximizing, and perhaps those aspects are more simple.
I don't find myself walking around thinking what would be rewarding. No.
Well, if you were an undergraduate, you know, and you would probably go around thinking about where you could find beer, and maybe you go to the party that has the most beer. I don't know. There's certainly situations
that are all very simple-minded explanations of human behavior, which I find quite inadequate.
No, I agree. No one's saying that's the whole thing. I'm just saying there's certainly aspects of behavior that may be just simply reward-driven, but nobody would argue that everything we do can be explained by a single scale of reward. I think even the most extreme practitioners of sort of reinforcement learning would be
probably weird
to think.
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. We recommend Monday.